Hey everyone, I'm your host Michael Nova, and welcome to Rise Up Radio. In this episode of Rise Up Radio, we speak with Rob Fusari, who's a Grammy Award-winning writer, producer, multi-instrumentalist, and recording artist who's achieved multi-platinum status working with artists such as Beyoncé, Britney Spears, Whitney Houston, Will Smith, and Lady Gaga, who he discovered. He worked with Destiny's Child on No 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 and Bootylicious, Whitney Houston's Love That Man, Will Smith's Wild Wild West, and Lady Gaga's first album, The Fame, and was featured as one of the top 10 songwriters in the world by Billboard magazine. Here's our interview with Rob Fusari. So, Rob, I've heard you talk about how you grew up in Livingston, New Jersey, finding your music passion in grade school as a child prodigy, performing at Carnegie Hall when you were 8 years old. You've been quoted as saying that you never considered doing anything else despite the challenges that you've had, but it didn't come easy for you. Can you tell us the story of how you experienced adversity early on when you first tried to launch your career?
Absolutely, Michael. You know, it's funny. One of the first things that come to mind, the first experiences that come to mind when you ask that question, is I lived in Livingston, one street behind me. So in other words, it was literally a minute and a half walk. Lived a very successful songwriter by the name of Sandy Linzer. Now, and Sandy Linzer wrote some big hits for Frankie Valli, for Whitney Houston. He wrote you could look him up. I mean, he's got a massive amount of hits. So, one of my first moves when I started writing songs, I had demoed a couple songs, in my early 20s, and I never considered myself a writer in the sense of I wasn't one of those, and I still am not. I'm not one of those writers who wakes up in the middle of the night, hears a song, and records it to his the dictaphone or what have you, or writes down a lyric. You know, I don't carry around a pad or a recorder because I'm not one of those writers who just hears things out of the air. But so when I was younger, I didn't think I was a songwriter, although I was playing the piano for many years and classically trained, and I was competing and, doing Carnegie Hall recitals, of some people say a prodigy sort. I didn't look at the writing thing as an option because it just – I didn't – I thought writers just heard these melodies and lyrics out of the air and kind of dictated them, if you will, from the heavens. But so that – that wasn't me, so I kind of brushed it off. But what I noticed what was happening with more with me when I would sit at the piano, something would happen when I heard chords and when I heard music. So in other words, if I would just, I'm very much into improvising. So although I did classical, which is, obviously music and you do the written notes, I love to take those classical pieces and kind of twist them up and take some of the harmony and the chords from them and do my own thing, if you will. So when I noticed when I did stuff like that on the piano, all of a sudden the melodies and the lyrics started coming. So it was like and to this day, I still need an instrument to write. I need to hear something first. So even if it's a drum beat, I could write. So it's just the way I do it, right? Everybody has their way. So back to the story, I had demoed up a couple of songs that I had written. These are like my first, two or three songs. And my first go-to was Sandy Linzer, who lived in the back street of where I grew up in Livingston. And so I went over, I had brought the, it was still cassette tape at the time, and Sandy Linzer listened to he took a meeting with me, being that we were neighbors, and I kind of knew of him around town a little bit. We weren't friends, but I knew of him, and he kind of knew of me and the family. And so he took the meeting, maybe at a being courteous or what have you. And I'll just never forget this. Sandy basically listened to a few of the songs, and he shook his head and he said, "Yeah, I don't think this music thing is for you." And I'm like, "Whoa!" You know, talk about like if words could kill. It was like it was being punched like in the stomach, you know, by like a 10,000-pound monster. It's just it hit me. It just hit me over the head. It just floored me. And I was like, you know, what do you say after that? I'm like, all right, well, you know, hey, thanks. But you know, that I guess what they say is that knocks you down. But you know, it's the ones that get up or the ones that are going to win somehow. So you know, for a couple of days, it kind of you know threw me off the horse. But you know, I got back up and I kept going. So you know, it was a blow, but it wasn't enough to say, you know, maybe it's not for me. I'm not going to start questioning it after, you know, one person's criticism. So I kept, you know, doing demos and, you know, getting better and better at the craft. I didn't really take into consideration that it is a craft and it has to be developed and you do get better at it. That's the thing about songwriting and production is people sometimes think, and I kind of made the mistake of thinking, either you have it or you don't, right? And to some extent, there's some truth to that, but it's not the whole picture. Because if I played some of my early work from that time now, I'd be like, geez, I don't think this guy has it. Do you know what I mean? But you do get better. And when you want it, you want, you know, because when you want it so bad and it's all you could think and it's all you could live and it's all you can eat, you don't have a choice. Mm. You know, it's like, you know, I always say to people, there wasn't really a choice. Even if I didn't get anything published or I didn't develop a Lady Gaga, I would still be doing this and still trying. You know, it just doesn't stop. It lives in you. It's something that that's why you're here. It's like, you know, you just know why you have to do it because you have no choice. So anyway, I kept writing and, interestingly enough, in the same town that I grew up in, there was another songwriter who had, some pretty big hits and his name was Irwin Levine. And Irwin Levine wrote Tie a Yellow Ribbon for Tony Orlando back in the 70s, and he had a bunch of hits as well. And it just so happened that my mother was close friends with a singer in the 50s who had some success by the name of Connie Francis. And Connie Francis had you know songs that were really big hits like Who's Sorry Now, Where the Boys Are. So Connie was a family friend for many years, and we would go to Connie's shows when she would perform locally. So one summer evening, we went to see Connie. She performed at the Garden State Arts Center, I think it was, over a particular summer. I don't recall the year, but we went backstage after the show, and that's when I had come face-to-face, and I had met Irwin Levine, who, like I said, lived in Livingston as well. And Irwin had written some songs for Connie. So he was, you know, he was friends with Connie. He knew Connie for years. So Irwin and I had got to talking backstage that night, and I had always at that time carried a demo with me. So I had passed along a demo to Irwin that night at Connie's show. At this point, I had given so many demos out, I didn't think I would hear from Irwin. But Irwin called me the next day. I put my phone number. I used to put my phone number on the tape, and he said, "Why don't you come by the house and meet with me?" And that was the first time that I was kind of invited into the real music scene, if you will. Because Irwin, you know, although he didn't have current hits, Irwin had a story, and Irwin really had that. He had that craft of songwriting. He knew how to craft a simple hook, a simple lyric, and he's really the guy who kind of taught me how to craft that lyric and how to craft that hook and how to keep it simple and all these. You know, I learned so much from Irwin. Irwin and I never had anything published, but Irwin really kind of was the school that I was able to go to kind of learn the craft of songwriting. So that's why I always tell people, it's like you can't look at it like, okay, this is my hit song and I'm going to get it to so-and-so and it's going to get cut. It's not about that. It's the steps. And, you know, all that writing I did was all to get to that next step, which was Irwin at this time. And then working with Irwin, got me to the next step. Now, needless to say, you know, it would still be many years before I would get a cut, even after working with Irwin. Because it's the craft. It took that many years to really just hone in on it. And like every time you do it, you're getting a little bit better. So, you know, you don't even see it sometimes, but it's like, you know, when you look back, it's like, oh my God, it creeps up and it gets better and better. And so all of a sudden it kind of starts to take form. So, you know, I would, at this point I was working with Irwin and like, you know, I wasn't making any money. I was completely broke. And, you know, I just, you know, it was like beg, borrow, and steal, you know, with $35 in the bank, still living home with mom, trying to figure out this music thing, because it was something that I just couldn't stop. And I couldn't find it in me to, you know, and it wasn't being lazy. It wasn't being, you know, a rebel, you know, because I wasn't afraid to work. I wasn't afraid to go out there and get a job. It was just that, the dream, when it's so strong, you can't escape it, you know. And I tried a couple times to kind of get these, you know, off-center jobs, but nothing would last. I would always have to go back to the music. So anyway, to propel forward, I kept writing. Irwin and I had kind of, you know, stopped working together a little bit, because we were doing it every day for a good 2-3 years, working and writing songs. And, you know, we couldn't really find anybody to produce them at that time, you know, because like yourself, it was like, nobody's going to do this for free. And I didn't have any money. And it was just, you know, we couldn't get the songs really even demoed, because we couldn't find any arrangers, producers to do it. So that's when I started, you know, producing and saying, you know what, if we can't find anybody, I'll just do it for now. And so I would start, you know, putting these really kind of, you know, weak productions together. But, you know, enough to get the song kind of in a form where you could hear it. So that's when I started to develop my craft as a producer, because I had no choice, right? So Irwin and I had stopped working at that, you know, shortly, two, three years after that. And I had just, you know, I had this thing where I would just always try to find people who were in it. At least, you know, to some degree. And, you know, it was always for me about surrounding myself or being around people who were really strong at what they did, you know. It's kind of like when you play, let's say, a sport, or you play tennis, what have you, and you play with somebody who's better than you, you're going to play better. So every time you get with somebody who's better and who's further along, it pushes you to go farther and to go harder and to really, you know, to go after it in a different way. You know, it's like the saying, you don't want to be, you know, a big fish in a little pond, and you never want to be the smartest guy in the room. It's all along those same lines of find people that really are good. And even if they haven't had success, you just know there's certain cats that just really do this, and they do this really well. So I had found a guy like that in West Orange, which was one town over from Livingston, by the name of Josh Thompson. And immediately Josh was this super talent, you know, guitar player, songwriter, who had this very urban sensibility, this very R&B urban sensibility. And it kind of introduced me into this whole different world of taking things a bit more urban and R&B. Because, I mean, I always loved that music. And I was listening to Babyface and R. Kelly at the time, Changing Faces. So it was a natural progression for me. Josh Thompson had just recently had a hit song as well with an artist by the name of Joe called All the Things Your Man Won't Do. And it was a spectacular record, because it didn't sound like anything else on the radio. You know, it had this acoustic guitar kind of arpeggiating through it. It just had a very interesting R&B old school feel that set it apart from everything else on the radio. So Josh Thompson and I started really working a lot, because we kind of like hit it off, and Josh dug what I did. I was getting better at my production, my songwriting. Josh and I would work together every day. And this also went on for a couple years. And Josh and I could not get anything going. We could not get a cut. I mean, we would go to record labels and just get flat out denied. Like it was, you know, like A&R guys picking up the phone as they're listening to the music with us there. It's like taking, you know, calls and writing and doing other, it was just so frustrating, man. It was like, oh my God. And I really started to think, you know, during this time, at one point when I had driven into one of these meetings, I think it was at A&M, and we were coming back, and the guy just hated everything. We were coming back out of the city, back into Jersey, and my car dies in the Lincoln Tunnel. Mm. And just like, oh my God. And I have no money for a tow. It's an old car. And I just remember saying to myself, I think that's it for me, man. I'm like, I think this thing has beat me. You know, I never thought this would beat me, but I really think that I'm really close. But of course, you know, I woke up the next morning, I got revived, and I went back to the drawing board, you know, to write, you know, yet another song. And I just, you know, I remember, during this time, you know, I was in my mother's basement, and, I was, you know, making records in this little tiny room that she had in her basement. And it was like 3 or 4 in the morning, and I was still working one night, and she came down, and, you know, my mother was like, what are you doing? She's like, now, because she didn't come from this world of, you know, trying, you know, really going after the dream, if you will. And she was just like, you got to stop, man. Like, you got to stop. You're going to wind up in an institution. This is insanity. You know, because she saw the hours I was putting in. She saw the frustration. She, you know, she saw it all. And like, you know, she would even come down sometimes and be like, wow, I like that song. I like that. I could hear it upstairs. I like that song you're working on. And at that point, I was like, oh, God, that's not a good sign. You know what I mean? I remember thinking, oh, thanks, but thinking to myself, all right, trash can for that one. I wasn't doing adult contemporary, you know, they were supposed to be kind of like, you know, hip kind of new R&B type stuff I was going for. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that must not be it if she's coming down liking the tune. Mm. So, you know, I would just take that as just another knock on the head. It's like, how many more knocks on the head? You know, and you know, I remember, like, you know, my family at the time, and look, they didn't know any better. They were like, bro, you're starting to look like this loser to us. You know, it was like, there was a perception of, you just don't want to work. You just want to kind of dilly-dally and kind of go after this quote-unquote dream. And it doesn't, we're all working over here. We're all making money. And you're over here, you know, my father had died when I was 17. So, you know, everyone kind of picked up and kind of held their own after that. But I still couldn't get it, you know, quote unquote, together, if you will, because I couldn't let this go. I would tell people, I'd rather die. If you give me a choice right now to stop music or die, I'm going to choose die. And I wouldn't even have to think about it. You know, it was that intense, man. It was the air I breathed, man. And it wasn't for, you know, the recognition. It was for the music. It was what the music did to me. It was a story I had to tell. It was something that lived in me that was just so massive that I you know, words couldn't explain it. So I had to keep going, and so I did. And you know, I had mentioned to Josh Thompson shortly after that Lincoln Tunnel breakdown in the car, I was thinking of giving up and just kind of going and getting a job. And, you know, I had a girlfriend at the time, and, you know, I was like, damn, man, I, you know, she's looking at me like she's ready to leave. Like, everybody's just ready to just give up on me. You know, it was like at that point. And, you know, I remember I just wanted to get out of my life. By this time, I'm like in my, you know, mid-20s. Coming into my, you know, maybe like 27, if you will. And I just remember starting to feel like that, what everyone was saying. It's almost like that self-fulfilling prophecy. If enough people say it, you start to believe it. So, you know, I was like, am I really just kind of stuck in my own head here? Is my stuff really not that good? And am I like just like in a bubble? Like, maybe it's really not that good. So, I mean, you know, those questions do start arising. I mean, how can they not? After, you know, this is going on now, I couldn't really get it cut. It was like 5 years maybe, really trying to do it hard. And I just couldn't get arrested. It was like, no matter what I played, no matter what I did, it was like nobody's heads were turning. So I had mentioned to Josh Thompson, I was thinking of stopping. He's like, bro, you can't stop. He's like, you don't understand. Like, you have something. You really do. And, you know, you want to believe that, but it's hard to believe that when there's nothing there that's showing or you know, signifying that you do have something. There's no, you know, there's nothing that supports that. So, you know, I remember Josh and I had kind of, you know, we kind of had fallen off a little bit in terms of we weren't working as much either. We were still friends, but, you know, I just kind of went into my own kind of little world and started, you know, kind of writing and doing things myself a little bit, which is a dangerous thing, you know, because you can get caught out there sometimes if you do that. It's a very slippery slope when you start working by yourself, especially in those early stages of writing, and because you need that, you need bouncing off of people, you need ideas, you need all kinds of things that collaboration brings that are so important. So anyway, I just went into this little bit of a, you know, hole for a minute and just started like kind of getting lost in my own thing. But, you know, what happened during that time was something was born, and that was a song called No, No, No. And that, you know, for whatever reason, you know, that turned out to be the one that somehow got to the surface. You know, was it the best one? No, of course not. It never really is the best one, but it was that one that, you know, it was the seed that would, you know, start everything else to grow. And, you know, that happened in a very kind of, unlikely way. And I was, you know, I just happened to be working on that tune. And, you know, I was like, I remember writing it and demoing the hook, and I had put a very basic track together. That was literally like, it was like a kick and snare and a keyboard and a bass. And I was like, Jesus, that's ultra simple. And like, it sounds so empty, but there was something about the emptiness that made it work. And I remember writing the tune, and I was struggling with the verses, but I had the hook. So I laid the hook down with the demo singer, and it was a guy, local guy I had met, you know, that was a singer, and he put the hook down, and I'm like, yeah, all right, let's leave the hook, and I'll play with the verse and see what happens. But I didn't think anything of it. You know, he kind of demoed it, and I listened back to it after he left, and I'm like, that's cool, I guess. And I just remember, like, you know, I went into the city that night, and the tune was still staying with me, but I'm like, this is horrendous. I've resorted to writing songs that are one note. And I was like, this, what has happened to me? I'm like, I went from, like, you know, this quote unquote prodigy classical pianist to writing one note song. I'm like, this song had one note. And I'm like, this can never work. What song has one note? So I went back into my like little disappointment in my mind that night, because I'm like, I got to scratch that one too. Cause that's like, it's garbage. Like, no, 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 no. When it's really, yeah, 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 yeah. I'm like, that's horrible. I'm like, I'm getting to a new low. But anyway, the point is that I am a few weeks later, I was revisiting some of my, you know, unfinished songs, and you know, I had this little Macintosh computer at the time, and that one came up. And during that time, like at the exact moment, my doorbell rings, and it's a friend of mine, a guy by the name of Calvin, who is a bass player, who, you know, I just, you know, I never really did anything with Calvin at that time. But, you know, we stayed close and we talked, and we'd always kind of, you know, just compare ideas. He would play me stuff he was doing, vice versa. He came over, but at this time he had brought someone he had met recently with him, a guy by the name of Vince Herbert. And Vince was a young producer out of Newark, New Jersey, who was, you know, getting into the game as a songwriter and producer. He had just worked on Aaliyah at the time, which it was Aaliyah's first album, so she wasn't really known. He had just done some Boys to Men stuff. So Vince was definitely in, you know, he wasn't a big time cat, but he was in enough, you know, where he was, like, people started to get to know who he was. So Vince Herbert had come over that day with Calvin, and we were just talking, and, you know, I was very pretty impressed. Vince was telling me what he was doing. I'm like, wow, that's amazing, man. That's really good luck to you. Like, I hope everything pans out, blah, blah, blah. And he, you know, Vince had asked me what, you know, what had I been working on? I'm like, oh, I don't, you know, nothing's really cut. I'm demoing, and I'm just, I keep writing, and I'm trying to get something cut, blah, blah, blah. So Vince asks if I could play him something, that I've written. And I'm easy enough to play him what's, you know, up and on the computer, and kind of, you know, what's running, if you will, that I could just press play and play it. So what was up was the hook of No, No, No. And I played the hook, and it got through about three quarters of the way through, and Vince stopped me. He's like, he shut that off. He's like, that's a hit song. That's it. And I'm like, you know what? This guy's really just some bullshit. He's like, what the, you know, like, come on, one more, like, do I really need this right now? Another bullshit, like, you know, this, you know, somebody telling me something that's not going to happen. And, you know, nothing ever seems to happen in this business. Everyone's like, yeah, it's great. And you never hear from, like, so I'm like, here's one more time to just, you know, bring me even closer to my demise, that this thing is over. So he's like, you know, he's like, can I get a copy of that? I'm like, what's the harm of giving this guy a copy of it? And, you know, at this point, because I'm like, I'm at the road's end. So I give Vince a copy of the hook. Mind you, there was still no verse on the recording yet. So he just had the music bed playing the verse, and then the hook would come in, and no, no, no would be heard with a male singer. And so Vince takes a copy, and I think it was later that night he had got my number from Calvin, who came with him that day. And he said he had played the demo recording for Teresa White, who was at Columbia. He said she's developing this new group on their first record. It's an R&B kind of, they're doing like a Supremes type of new, you know, modern day Supremes. And he had played her No, 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 and they want to cut it with this group, Destiny's Child. So I'm like, well, that's amazing. I mean, I think, you know, as far as I can tell. So Vince says to me, I'm going to have a delivery service deliver, 4 DA88 machines to your mom's house so you could track the music to No, 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 so they can cut the vocal. Hmm. I mean, I had never tracked music, or I had never operated a DA88 machine. So I was sweating to say the least. But you know, luckily when he sent the DA88, they sent the manual, and you know, it literally took me about a day to get the thing tracked, because I had to figure out how to lay Simpty code and had to, you know, lock up the machines, and it was a nightmare. And I'm like, God, what? But you know, it was like, sometimes you got to get thrown into it, and you get thrown into it hard. And so I had gotten through tracking the music, and a couple of days later, he had said they were going to start cutting the vocal. You know, could I come up with the verses and bring something into? They were tracking at Chung King, which is a recording studio in the city in Lower Manhattan. So I did just that, and I'll never forget, you know, walking in and, you know, really meeting the girls of Destiny's Child for the first time. They were very quiet and reserved, and I was, you know, they never knew I had never stepped foot in a recording studio before. This was my first time in a recording studio. But, you know, you play it off, you fake it till you make it. So I remember, you know, as we started, Vince said to me, you know, he kind of pointed to a chair, he put his hand on the chair, and said, Rob, you sit here. And basically what he was saying was, Rob, you produce the vocal. So, you know, you're the writer, so produce the vocal. And I'm like, oh, what the hell? Like, so there goes into the booth with the first one was Beyonce. So in retrospect, now looking at it, I'm like, I'm sitting here telling Beyonce how to sing. I'm like, what the? Now I look at that, it just seems so bizarre to me. You know, I mean, and I just remember, you know, hearing that Beyonce sing that first line of the hook. And I just remember like, you know, it's like that commercial that used to be on TV years ago for Maxell, the audio, that your head is just blown back with like the wind, because it's so the force, you know. It was like, that was the feeling when Beyonce sang that first line. I was like, home, what the hell? She brought the thing just to a whole different place that I never even imagined the song to go to. And you know, I couldn't help myself but keep her in the booth as long as I could, you know. So I actually had Beyonce you know, record the whole hook, the harmonies and everything. And then I kind of, you know, I filled in some of the other stuff with the other girls, but she just sounded so, it was beyond me. And I was just like, I don't care what anybody else sounds like. I'm like, just, she just, it's amazing. So, you know, long story short, you know, we got the record done, and, you know, I had no idea what would happen. You know, I wasn't paid. I didn't sign any contracts. And you know what? I didn't ask because, you know, who was I to ask? And I always tell people, like, do not, early in your career, just don't be difficult. Just, you got to go with it. You know, you're going to take some lumps. But you know what? No one wants to work with people who are difficult and you know, people who ask too many questions and, you know, people who, you know, who was I to start talking about contracts? You know, and I really think in retrospect, if I did start talking about contracts, I would have never been asked back in because I know some cats that were like that. And, you know, I had tried to bring some cats into situations and they just started asking too many questions to the record label and the artist and the artist. And I won't mention who it is, but it's like big time people would say to me, yo, do not bring that person back in here.
Hmm.
Wow. So, you know, I don't know why I knew that, you know, it was just instinct that was telling me just to shut up because, you know, I couldn't get, you know, anything going on anyway. I think this was my break. This was my shot.
Yeah.
And if I blew this, then that was it. It was over. So I just kept my mouth shut. And, you know, I never did, a contract. Or never got paid any royalties on No No No. But, you know, the one thing that amazed me was that when the record came out, I got credit. And I was almost, you know, now, thinking about it now, I'm really surprised that I got credit. Because I didn't know how the game works, and a lot of people don't get credit. You know, especially those early days in their career. And the fact that at least, you know, Vince Herbert gave me the credit as, you know, writer producer on the record was huge. It was, you know, that was the payment, you know, for me, you know, but you know, that whole thing was enough for Vince Herbert after that record to say, I want you to move out to Los Angeles and I want you to work on everything with me. And everything was everything. And so all of a sudden I went from my mother's basement to not being able to get arrested, to being in the likes of people like Master P, Bone Thugs and Harmony, I was working with Montel Jordan, Queen Latifah. I mean, the list went on, and every day, Vincent Herbert would pick me up, you know, at like 10 o'clock in the morning. He would drop me at whatever studio we were working in, and he would come back later that night. The song would be done, produced, written, and the artist would start cutting. And this was a daily routine. And I'm talking about almost a song a day.
You were in.
Right. I was in.
Yeah.
I was in. So what happens here, so we start having, you know, a lot of success, like records. You know, I did some stuff on the Rush Hour soundtrack, Master P's records. All these records started coming out. And at that time, everything just started going to number one. So it was like number one after number one after number one. It was like, it was insane. But, you know, like, I guess it was like maybe a year into it, I looked around and I said, Jesus, I haven't been paid on anything. So here, like, you know, you're looking at yourself on the charts and you're hearing your stuff on the radio and it's incredible. But I think, you know, I think Vince Herbert gave me like $10,000 in cash one day for like everything. And I just remember like I had the cash like under my TV at the apartment that they were renting for me at that time. Because I'm like, I thought it was, all right, I hit the jackpot. So, but I remember, you know, I'll never forget, we were working on, about a year into it, we were working on an artist by the name of Queenpen, which is a rapper at the time. And, you know, I had it, and I said, Vince, I said, I think I'm going to go back to Jersey and kind of just regroup. And, you know, it's been a while, I haven't been back. And he, you know, he knew it was coming. And he, you know, he just kind of said, you know what? I hear you. Have a safe flight back. It wasn't like, oh, you know, Rob, just stay and like, you know, we'll work stuff out. Vince wasn't going to pay me. This is the way it was.
Oh,
Vince wasn't going to give me producer royalties. He wasn't going to do what, you know, you're supposed to do, if you will. He was going to wait for the time when I was going to say goodbye. And when I said goodbye, he was ready for it.
Jeez.
And he said, oh, and he had someone right behind me.
Oh.
Waiting to go right into the slot.
Mm.
But this is how, this is the business that we live in, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I remember on the plane ride back, you know, I was pretty shook up. because I didn't know what, how, you know, because Vince was the guy who was taking all my music and taking it into the labels, and he didn't want me to meet the people at the labels, or, you know, he would kind of keep me kind of, you know, hidden, if you will.
Jeez.
Yeah. You know, so I wasn't even developing a lot of relationships. I did develop some. And one of the relationships that kind of fell into place was the Will Smith relationship, because Tatiana Lee is one of the artists, you know, that was on Will's label. She was on the show Fresh Prince, and they had done a record on her. And Vince wasn't around that day when Tatiana's manager, who was also Will Smith's manager, came in and was talking to me and got to know me a little bit and started to understand, oh, it was me that was doing everything. It wasn't Vince. So that was one of the people that started to put the pieces of the puzzle together. Which, look, I mean, that goes on a lot in the record business. It just that's, you know, you hear of the ghost kind of writers and, you know, Puffy and all these guys, like, you know, it happens, you know, and it's just the way it is sometimes. So, you know, you kind of want to break out of that at some point as one of those ghost people, and usually do. So that's what my intent was, and I made a bunch of calls when I got back to Jersey to try to get my own kind of thing off the ground. Because you know, from this point, everything, you know, that I had, you know, produced and written, you know, it was always produced and written by Vincent Herbert and Rob Fusari. That wasn't the case. You know, it was, you know, Vince wasn't even around, you know, half the time. And, you know, so that was frustrating for me too, but it also kind of, it made me stop and say, you know what, maybe it's time to just do, you know, Rob Fusari and start to, you know, to get my own thing and, you know, to gain those relationships and to, you know, to start doing stuff as a solo producer. So that's when, you know, I had reached out to a bunch of people, as I said, and one of the people was Tatiana's manager, again, this guy by the name of Omar Rambert. And Omar, you know, he took my call and he was really cool. And he said, you know, the only thing that we're doing is Will Smith is getting ready to do this new movie, Wild Wild West. And he's like, you know, look, we're probably using Trackmasters, who were the producers who did all the Will Smith stuff. I mean, they were like, they did everything. Like they were a team. So he's like, I don't know really if there's anything there, but, you know, look, if you want to submit something, although I'm telling you right now, Trackmasters is probably going to do the song that Will's looking for Wild Wild West, you could try. And, you know, so I did. And I said, you know, I'm going to give him a couple ideas. So I remember, you know, obviously Will was a sample type of bass artist. So I put together two ideas. One was with Earth, Wind & Fire, the song September, and the other one was with Stevie Wonder's I Wish. And I had sent it to Omar, and Omar really responded to it. He's like, I want to play it for Will. And, you know, he's like, well, what kind of money would you be looking for this? I'm like, Omar, I'm not going to talk money with you. That's ridiculous. I'm like, whatever, man. I'm not – whatever you think is fair, dude. Like, again, it wasn't about making demands. It was about, you know, getting things going. And so anyway, he played it for Will. Will freaked out over the track to with the I Wish sample, and he invited me to his house in Los Angeles. And I just remember I flew out to Los Angeles, and they put me in a hotel near Will's house. And I remember that day we were starting to write. Will calls me and he goes, "I'm going to pick you up in like 15 minutes at the hotel." I'm like, "All right." So I'll never forget the vision of Will Smith pulling around the front part of the hotel in his red Bentley. It's like a candy red Bentley to pick me up. I was like, "This is just weird. Like, this is like, you know, this is just it's like surreal. Life. You know, I'm like living like in this kind of haze, like this fog." And he took me back to his house. And he had just built a studio, and we started putting together the writing for Wild Wild West. And you know, I had told him that I wanted to make some tweaks and add some stuff to the track. So I kept working on the track and writing lyrics, and we just kept, you know, developing the idea until it got to the point. And then, you know, we just started talking, brainstorming about, oh, what if we get, you know, Cisco from Drew Hillison, the hook, and Kumo. So we had all these ideas. We were bouncing off each other. That really, you know, that led to a pretty good collaboration. But, you know, I remember we had finished Wild Wild West, and I remember listening back, you know, at the mix session, hearing the record, and I had called a friend of mine at the time. Yeah, I'm like, wow, man, I just did this record on Will Smith, and I think it's horrible. I'm like, I think this is one of the worst records I've done. And I remember telling him that, because I didn't, after, like, it was, there was so much in the record going on that I couldn't even hear it anymore. I couldn't relate to it, you know? And I didn't think the record would go anywhere. So I kind of brushed it off as like, you know, wow, I'm going to be the guy who ends Will Smith's recording career. I remember thinking that to myself, because I felt the record was that bad. So anyway, it came out, it did well. You know, it set me on a new path into writing and producing for more people. I wound up after that working on the next Destiny's Child record and did four songs with them again. I regrouped with them. And then, you know, after I had done a bunch of records after several years, I just really wanted to find an artist, man. I wanted to be part of it. You know, I could never get into the nitty gritty with a lot of these artists, because I wanted, you know, it was like, we need a record like this, or we did the whole album, but we need a single. It was never like, Rob, help us develop a direction and a sound, you know, and a vision. Hmm. It was always like, Rob, here's the vision, here's the sound and the direction. Give us something that complements it, and that feels like a single.
You wanted freedom. You wanted creative freedom.
Very much. And, you know, there's a certain pressure. At the time, I didn't mind, but there's a certain almost unrealistic pressure when a record label comes to you and they say, we need the single. We cut 30 songs, but we have no single. Hmm. And I think to myself, well, why did you cut 30 songs? Why would you cut a single first, right? Something that feels like a single. I never understood it. Hmm. So they would come to me after and say, we need the single. Hmm. And there's a certain, okay, so I'm going to have 3 hours with your artist. Don't even know them. I'm going to meet him that day. And you're saying to me, give me a single. That's just, it's not realistic. Yeah. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's what started to get to me after a while. I'm like, I need to know the artist. I need to know what to write about. I need to know, you know, how to connect the marriage. It's like, it's not a 3-hour thing. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe for some cats it is, but for me, it just wasn't becoming that anymore. It was like, I really want to create the single, not like give somebody a single. It's not an assembly line.
Yeah.
And I never wanted to be an assembly line producer. So anyway, that's what kind of drove me into this. I started holding auditions looking, I wanted to do a female Strokes thing. I was really into the Strokes, and I wanted to get this female chick who was kind of lo-fi, raw, but very melodic. You know, something about the Strokes are still very melodic and pop. But, you know, it's kind of indie. So I kind of set out to look for this, you know, this artist. And I searched high and low. And I found the one. And I started developing her. It was an artist by the name of Lena Morgana. And Lena was just amazing. She was everything that I had hoped for. I lucked up on this unbelievable artist who just was – she was it. Hmm. And, you know, unfortunately, Lena committed suicide a few years after I had met her. And we were in the midst of really developing her thing. And, you know, it was strong. And it kind of – obviously, it threw me for a loop. And it kind of stopped the train for a while. Hmm. But, you know – I kind of given up, you know, on this Strokes girl, quote unquote, artist thing when I was introduced to a girl by the name of Stephanie Germanotta, who, you know, turns out to be Lady Gaga. And I remember the night I was introduced to her, I went to she had a Pure Volume page. It was like a MySpace thing. And as I was speaking to her on the phone, I was kind of listening to her one ear, and I had called up her Pure Volume page, so I had it low, and I was listening to the music with the other ear, and I'm like, all right, there's something here. I mean, it sounds like kind of Gwen Stefani cover bandish, but you know, you could tell when there's something else there. There's like a diamond in the rough, and it was enough there where I, you know, I wanted to at least meet her and get the vibe. And, you know, and then I invited her to my studio in Jersey. She came in and it just, I thought to myself when I met her, like, this isn't the girl. It's not what I'm looking for. She seemed cool, but the image was just, it just wasn't for me. But, you know, she had taken the bus out from New York City to Jersey that night. It was her birthday. I remember that. And I'm like, I'm not going to, you know, be a jerk and, like, send her back. I'm going to, like,
nice birthday present. Get out of here.
Yeah, go home. Nice meeting you. So it was like, I'm like, I gotta take the meeting and talk with her. Maybe I could, you know, point her into some different directions, maybe get her, help her some, you know, meet some other people. So then I, you know, about an hour into it, she was talking though. I can't even tell you what she said that night because I was half listening. I was like, I wasn't interested. You know, I had a guy who used to work with me at the time, a guy by the name of Tom Kabacki, and he was there. So he was talking to her. But, you know, I was just like, all right, are we done yet with this? But, you know, when she was talking, she had mentioned she plays the piano and you know, she's been writing some new things. So I'm like, you know what, before you go, why don't you come back into the control room and there's a piano in there and let me hear you play. Let me sing something. And, you know, when that happened, it was like, I was like, oh my God. I just, like, time stood still. It was like everything kind of, when she sang the first line, I'll never forget, it was a song that she had written called Hollywood. And she sat at the piano and, you know, she started playing this intro and I just noticed the way she was kind of, her body was hitting the piano. It was this very jerky, Jerry Lee Lewis meets Elton John thing, where I was like, wow, I haven't really seen anybody play the piano like this. It wasn't the playing. It was the way her body was moving and you know, kind of gyrating with the piano, if you will. And I just remember finding that, you know, like she was kind of like the shelves were kind of shaking in the studio because she was moving the piano kind of like back and forth, right? So I remember that kind of immediately struck me as, whoa, what is this? And then she sang the first line, and I noticed that she had a very quirky backwards way that I dug of writing lyrics. And, you know, I had, by this point I had written with so many people. I mean, top songwriters in the world, the Kathy Dennises and, you know, the Beyoncés of the world. And I just remember thinking to myself, whoa, she's kind of writing inside out in a way.
How was she doing that?
You know, it was the way she used the words. It was the way she flipped the phrases. Hmm. It had this kind of like upside down thing to it that I was very intrigued about. I'm like, because I wouldn't say things like that. She had a way of saying things. So, you know, this would happen a lot when we would write. I would say a line, and she would flip the line just enough to say it in her own way that was very quirky.
Hmm.
And what it did is it takes the songwriter out of it, and it puts the artist in it. And that's what every great artist has. You know, the Springsteens, the Bob Dylans of the world, they have that way of twisting the lyric into their own way of saying it, their own, you know, phrasing, if you will.
Yep.
She had, and it was very, you know, the way she would say things were upside down, and I dug it. And so I'm like, I immediately took to her, and I stopped everything I was doing. I immediately, you know, said, let's work. And she would come to the studio every day, you know, and she would be there early, like waiting for me. And I just always found that to be fascinating. I'm like, this girl really wants it.
Hmm.
You know, 9, 10 o'clock, she would take the bus and she'd be waiting outside the studio by 10 o'clock when I would get there. So anyway, we worked and we developed, you know, this Beatles, Led Zeppelin kind of rocking thing. And we cut like 20 songs that were very Beatles, Led Zeppelin hard and interesting. And they were good, but they weren't really her. And they just kind of they were missing something. And I just didn't feel strong enough about them to take them into the record labels yet. So I ran it by one of my friends who's an A&R guy, and he just got back to me. He's like, yeah, I don't know, dude. It's like, I don't see it. I don't hear it. I don't hear anything. And, you know, I ran it by my manager at the time. He was like, you got to move on, bro. Like, this girl, he's like, this girl doesn't have it. And he tried so hard to get me to move off the project because he was like, dude, I can get you, like, there's 10 people that want to work with you right now. I'm like, bro, I can't. I'm telling you, this girl's got it. You got to just trust me. So I wound up shifting directions and tried to bring it more of a dance kind of quirky electronic rock element to it. Because, you know, she was rock and roll. She still is. very much to the bone. She's a rock and roll artist. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of music you're doing. It's the mentality. It's the attitude that is rock and roll, and she has that rock and roll thing. So anyway, so I tried to incorporate some rock and roll with the world of, you know, drum machine, electronic. And that's when the thing really kind of came together. And every record label was just floored, and everybody was, you know, wanted to meet her and taking us to dinners and everything. It was like carte blanche. It was like, 'cause everybody wanted her so bad. You know, after hearing the music, and, you know, we would go to the meetings and she would sit down and do that thing she did for me at the piano, and everyone kind of reacted the way I did. It was like, whoa, this is some whole other shit.
So after Lady Gaga, you ran into some career turbulence at this point. What happened?
Well, you know, without, you know, getting into the details, what happens is, you know, anytime you spend, you know, a good deal of time with an artist and, you know, there's that tough love part of it. You know, somebody said something to me once that made a lot of sense. They said an artist, when they make it, they don't want to be reminded of the time when they were broke and they couldn't get arrested. They couldn't get a break. And I think that, you know, I was that time in her life when she was trying to make it. And, you know, she was sleeping on the couch in the studio. And it was that time that was, she wasn't Lady Gaga. She was Stephanie Germanotta. And, you know, there were times where, you know, for instance, you know, we would write something and she like, it's great. I'm like, no, I'm like, Stephanie, it's not great. It's actually not even good. Like, I want to rewrite it. And she would, you know, she would get so upset sometimes. And, you know, but it's these things that, you know, it's like the tough love, you know, it's like not everything we do is great. And it's like, it can be better. And I think me pushing her that way is what, you know, what brought the thing, to where it needed to be. But, you know, I think, listen, I mean, in complete honesty, I don't, any artist, and look, I can understand this from doing the artist thing. Any artist doesn't want really the masses to know that there was something else behind it. You know, and I guess that's how it should be, right? I mean, it doesn't mean that the artist and that something behind it have to fall, you know, off, you know, out of the relationship. But I think that sometimes an artist feels that they have to cut off that thing that was the energy and the catalyst behind it, because it feels like they think it's going to come off fake, you know, or it's going to come off assembly line, you know, or well, what ideas were Rob's? What ideas were her? You know, was it really Rob's name? Was it, you know, there's all those questions that they don't want to deal with. And, you know, she never gave me the chance of realizing that I'm not that guy. I'm not that person who's like, well, yeah, you know, it was when we wrote this song, it was my line. It was my idea. I'm not that guy.
So where did you go from there now that, you know, you had these hits, you were on top, and you know, now you were faced with like another place to go in your career.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I thought I would do it again, and in my kind of feeble mind, I thought that's what I wanted to do, is like, let me find the next thing and then develop, you know, something even better. Because I always thought, well, you know, man, it could have been better. I could have done the Gaga project better. I wanted it to be like this. And so I had all these ideas of the next one. And then all these artists were emailing and calling and writing and showing up waiting outside the studio in my house and literally like sleeping there, like, 'cause they thought they were the next Lady Gaga. And the kiss of death for any artist that would come to me was that if they said that, if they go, I'm the next Lady Gaga, I'd be like, you know what? I don't even want to hear you saying. Because just you saying that is like not what I'm looking for. You know what I mean? So I would get these emails, and I would literally, I could tell by the first line of an email if I was going to listen to the music, because it was like, you know, I want to listen to everything, and I try to listen to everything, but some people were just like, you got to come at this the right way, and like, I'm the next Lady Gaga. Why would you want to be?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'll be the next you, because I don't want to hear, you know, it was like I was onto that page and I was looking for that next thing. But you know what? I think I was in a bubble a bit and I was looking for something very specific. I didn't find it. And I recorded a bunch of stuff and a bunch of artists, but I didn't find it. And what started to happen was I was losing me. I was losing the music. All of a sudden, just the music just, I'm like, I would listen out of the speakers. I'd be like, what is going on right now? I'm like, I'm not here. I'm not, I can't even hear this music. Like shut that off. Yeah. And it was my own music.
Mm.
So that's when I had to stop. And I woke up one day and I'll never forget. It was my birthday. And I said, that's it. That's it. I had spent $200,000 in 3 months at the studio doing demos. And I got the studio bill and I was like, whoa, what?
Wow.
I didn't even see it. I was going so hard. I was there night and day. I was sleeping there. I was like, and I was in New York at the time. I lived in New York. So it was expensive. But the point is that I woke up and I'm like, I got to put the brakes on. And I'm like, I need to hear something. I need to write something that makes me stop. And what I did was I woke up and I wrote a song. My mother used to say this phrase about my brother when she would get mad at him. She would go, he's a jack of all trades and a master of none. So I just, that always stuck with me. And I wrote a song that morning called Master of None. And it was kind of, you know, there was something, I guess, you know, I was talking about my life, I think, in some respect in the lyric. And it had this very early Depeche Mode kind of thing to it. And I remember, like, I wrote it in like 10 minutes and I put the track together in like 20 minutes. And I'm like, Jesus, this is what I used to do. Like, what happened to me, you know? And it had this kind of dark kind of like thing that I just, that moved me. And I, you know, I just remember like being moved for the first time in years for the music. And I wasn't even thinking about finding somebody to record the vocal. I'm like, I'm not even going to mess it up, like mess my whole vibe up right now. I'm just going to record a vocal. I don't care if it's terrible. I'm just going to do it how I hear it. And when I did that, and I'm, you know, I never considered myself a singer, and I still don't consider myself a singer, but it was a style thing. And I laid it down. I went to the studio later that day. I laid the vocal. And I remember I had stepped out for a little while. I went to dinner with some friends. It was my birthday for a celebration. And I came back and there were a few people around the console listening to the song, and they were just like, they're like, bro, why are you not doing your own thing? Like, why are you not just recording your? I'm like, you know what? You know, it's not a bad idea at this point. It's like, you know, what else? What do I got to lose? So that's when, you know, that's where the karaoke thing, you know, had started. And I started just, it was kind of like, instead of journaling, like some people write in a diary, some people go see a shrink. I was like, I was doing everything through lyric. And I was kind of, in a very kind of like, you know, I don't want to say cryptic, but in a way that people could relate to, where I wasn't being obvious about things. But I needed to tell my story almost like to get it out just for myself, you know, through song. And that's, you know, that's when I started doing the karaoke thing. So it was a whole different, you know, it kind of saved me, I guess, in a way. It kind of saved my life, because I don't think I was going down a very good road at that time. I think things were starting to happen that shouldn't have been happening, and I was doing things that I shouldn't have been doing. And yeah, you know, it's you know, when the mind starts to get a little warped and off track, you know, especially with an artist and a musician and a, you know, anyone of that, you know, creativity, you can get into some really, you know, sticky situations quick. And that's what started happening. So I think karaoke came along and like kind of like pulled me back, you know, into, you know, out of the kind of the hands of death, if you will. And I always say, and I mean that, I don't say that lightly or to be, you know, dramatic over the top. It's the truth. And, you know, but we all get saved in our own way. And I think that was the music trying to save me.
Yeah. So you went back to your roots in a way. You went back to
starting over.
Yeah, to what was in your heart. So yeah, right. Karaoke was the name of the project, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And you went, you used an alter ego name, 8-Bit, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So are you still doing it?
I'm still doing it. I just did a tour. It's funny you had mentioned ABC. I toured with ABC last year. I opened for them in their England during their England tour. So, yes, I am still doing it. I'm taking a little break from it because I guess the life on the road, I didn't really prepare myself that well for the life on the road. Mm. And I didn't realize how grueling it is. And I give a lot of credit to artists who tour, man, because, I mean, I'm older now, but it's like, it was the city to city, and like, it just started to really wear on me. And, you know, you can't show that. And especially you're the opening act. You gotta be on, and you gotta be, and I kept it together and positive, obviously, the whole time. But I just remember coming back from the tour and being like, whoa. Like this, you know, people think, and it's like, sounds great, and you're on the bus, and you're your friends, and you're partying, and you know, that lasts for like 2 days. And then it's like the real life kind of sets in, and it's life on the road. And that kind of, you know, that kind of started setting in for me in a strange way. And I was like, you know, I love performing. Look, being on the stage, and that is everything. That's life. But it's that people don't take into consideration that there's a lot of time between those, you know, that half hour, you know, you do, you know, for an opening set and to the next one. And so that was the part, you know, it was being away from your family. It was, you know, it's a different life, man. And I needed to, you know, and ABC had invited me out to do more shows recently. And I kind of passed, you know, I got to think about that part. If this is the life that I do want at this point, you know, my age and in my career, look, I do want to perform, and I love doing karaoke, and I love, you know, that part, you know, that part of that chapter, if you will. People always ask me if I'm going to ever produce other artists again. And I don't want to say no. I mean, if you asked me that 2-3 years ago, I would say absolutely not. But it's not because of the Gaga thing. It's just because I don't know if I could do that. That chapter seems to be over now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So how did you hook up with ABC in the first place? Because I know, you kind of grew up listening to their music, right?
It's a great question, and it's the funniest thing because I hooked up with ABC because Jane, who works with my company, I had an idea that Jane was helping me with, and I was going to do this project, karaoke, basically doing co-writes and duets with all my favorite artists from the 80s. So we had reached out to a bunch of artists, you know, about the project, and we started talking to Barry Gibb. And, you know, a bunch of other, the Boy George we were talking to. And one of the artists that responded very positively at the time was ABC with Martin Fry. So, you know, Jane had set up a meeting and I went to meet Martin Fry. And I got to tell you, like, I just didn't realize the inspiration that ABC has played, you know, in my music and writing. And I guess Martin heard it when, you know, Jane had sent him some of the karaoke stuff. He was like, yeah, this guy, there's some ABC here. So, you know, when I went to meet Martin in the city shortly after that, that connect, and, you know, look, we hit it off, and it was a really cool vibe. And Martin was, he just wasn't really in a place at that time where he really wanted to do any recording or anything new. He was doing some shows, still doing the ABC stuff. And he's like, you know, he was a little disheartened by, you know, the business and the, you know, some of the, where he was at. But he's, you know, we ended the meeting in him saying, look, if you have any ideas and you want to maybe pass them by me, or, you know, maybe we'll try to co-write or something. It was very kind of much a brush kind of brushed me off in a way. But it didn't stop me. I went back and I put together some ideas that night, and I sent them out that same week. And I didn't hear from Martin for a while after I sent them out, but I guess it was like 3 weeks later Because what I would do is I would put together track ideas. And then what I would do is I would sing kind of dummy lyrics and melodies over it. And then I would also give the artist, like a Martin, just the track. So if you like some of my ideas, use them. And then, but here's a blank track as well. So if you want to write your own melody lyric. So I remember I didn't hear from Martin. I'm like, I guess that there goes that. Martin reaches out to me like a month later. He's like, man, I wrote to all those tracks. And he sent me back his vocal demoing the songs that he had written, with some of my ideas as well as some of his, and he demoed them. And I got to tell you, like, I thought like I had kind of reached that height of my career, and then hearing Martin, doing this stuff and collaborating with me, even this in this fashion, was a whole new high for me that I just said, oh my God. Like, this puts everything else for me to shame, because it was like, I felt like this was it. This was where it all was coming to. Because it, again, like what you said earlier, it was ABC is how it started, in the sense of me, like, in front of my mother's TV, watching the Look of Love video, in complete fucking awe and shock of what I was hearing and looking at, that I just said, I remember, and I told this story on stage when I was opening for them. I would say, I would just listen to this music on MTV and say to myself, gee, if I could ever do something even close to that, God, it's like magic. It's like lightning in a bottle what I'm hearing. It's like, It would. I couldn't even touch it. It was like, to me, it just moved me so, because it was pop, but it was interesting pop. You know, it had this dark thing, but it wasn't dark. It's like it had all these elements I loved, and needless to say, but the long and short of it is, so Martin demos these songs, I'm like, dude, this shit, like, I don't even know. I mean, you just sound great on this shit. I'm like, he's like, if you want to use something for karaoke or we could do some duet stuff. I'm like, yeah. You know what I mean? So anyway, so I'm like, so I start laying down some of the vocals to the stuff that he wrote, for karaoke. At that point, Martin, we don't speak for like a couple months. I get a call from Martin. A couple months later, he goes, hey, man, I played some of the stuff over at EMI, and they want to give ABC a new deal.
Wow.
With those songs. I'm like, what? So obviously, I abandoned, the karaoke thing. I'm like, dude, brother, yours. Like, do it. So that's when, they make the record, the new ABC record. It comes out. It goes top five in England, and, they're back off to the races over there. And he, shortly after that, he invites me on the tour. He's like, why don't you come out on tour? We'll do some of the new songs that we wrote, and you could open up the show, karaoke, blah, blah, blah. And so that's how it all came together.
Great. I love that.
Yeah, it's great. And he's like, first, he's just the best guy like you ever want to meet. Talk about just vintage, just good attitude. This is why I got in, and that's why it kind of coming back here made the whole story kind of go full circle and completes itself in a way.
Yeah. So for all the unsigned artists out there, what advice can you give in terms of getting heard through all this immense competition that we have now with the internet, and how seemingly everyone seems to call themselves a musician now? It's like, we always hear this, that if you write great songs, you will be found. But that's really, it's bull, because, I know myself so many great musicians who have great songs, but they don't have the connections. So yeah. What advice can you give to unsigned musicians out there, other than the obvious point of writing great music? How can they really get heard?
I'm going to tell you, it might sound oversimplified, but it's not, because I've lived it and I've seen it now. I hear a lot when I meet new artists and musicians and writers, I hear the negotiating going on in their mind, and the contemplating of, well, I don't know if I should do that, or if I don't know if that makes sense. Those things like that should never be even said. Because what's going to happen when it, and it will happen, right? Because I always say the only reason it doesn't happen is because you stop. But what's going to happen is something that you couldn't even dream in terms of how it's going to happen. So in other words, and look, I'm guilty of it too sometimes. Like, yeah, I don't want to send the song to, or I don't want to do that tour, or I don't want, it's the biggest mistake, because the main thing that helped me along all these years from the beginning was doing everything. And I didn't say that's probably not right, or that's not going to work, or you know what, that's too small. Like, you could play the song for your uncle, and that's the way all of a sudden it happens. So you know what, you got to come to terms with the fact that it's going to happen in this most off-center, odd way that no matter what you do, you cannot even think of. Don't contemplate it, because what you'll do, and I see this with new artists all the time. Like, yeah, I don't think that's for me. Like, really? You have nothing, and you don't think that's for you. You know what I mean? It's like, what do you think is not, that doesn't make any sense to me, because it's everything to get the littlest bite, because you don't know where that bite is.
Yeah. Do it.
It's like, that's right. You know what? Because think about it. Like, if you put it into the simplest form and the simplest mentality, it's that if you're real about it, which I believe you are, because you're doing it right, you just want people to listen and just to be heard. So who cares who it is, when it is, your uncle, your aunt, the president of a label, America, this one, that one, it doesn't matter. Because, you know, it's like somebody said to me, a couple of weeks ago, I had done a small show for a buddy who is doing a charity. He's like, you know, this was kind of, did you feel like this was small time for you? Like, you know, it was only a couple hundred people there. I'm like, Dave, you don't understand. Like, I can't tell the difference. Like, my body and my mind and soul, when it goes out and it performs, it's the same feeling to me if one person is in the audience or if it's 100,000. It's like, cause it's not, it's, it, I don't, my body and soul can't tell the difference. And that's what it's about. So, you know, it's like, You could contemplate this thing like, you know, all day long, but that's all you're going to do. You just and you know, and like I said to you earlier, like, I thought Wild Wild West was garbage. And here it turns out to be my, like, one of my biggest, like, you just, like, you don't know. It's like, you don't know. So why even try to drive that bus when you're not even on the bus? Like, let's just let it go.
Yeah.
And just go.
Yeah, so when you've been faced with adversity, and we've discussed this, whenever you've had roadblocks in your life, what does the phrase "fall down 7 times, rise up 8" mean to you personally when you've experienced it in your life?
You know, what it means is that, you know, when there's real passion and you're really meant to do it, it's like you just the fall is knowing that you're one step closer to the rise. It's like, you know what? You got to miss, and you got to miss and miss and miss to get to that. If you're not missing, you're making a mistake. If you're not falling, there's something wrong.
Right. So it's like Thomas Edison said, I haven't failed. I just found 10,000 ways that didn't work.
That's exactly it.
And I'm just going to keep going.
But knowing that in conjunction with knowing that every time you fail, you just take one more step closer.
Right.
So it's really, if you look at it that way, it's an advance. It's not a setback. It's an advance.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, you talked about how your car broke down in the tunnel.
Yeah.
And you were ready to give it up.
Yeah.
But you just couldn't, because it was in your heart and in your soul. And
right. That's the thing. You have to ask yourself that question. Why do you want it? You know, and what is it that's driving you? And my answer is always the same. Because there's no choice.
Right.
There's no contemplation, because I don't have anything to contemplate. There wasn't ever a choice. Like, oh, well, you know, maybe I'll do that. There was no choice.
Yeah.
You gotta answer it that way. If you're not answering it that way, then maybe it's not for you, which is okay. But, you know, you gotta be that adamant about, like, I have to do this.
Yeah, I felt the same way that you did it. And then I just, it was the same thing. It was just, you know, I would just turn on the music and I'd say, oh, it's calling me back. It's
right?
calling me back, you know?
You know, it's, like, it's your project. Like the project you told me about in the beginning.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was it. Yeah. That first, you had to get it done.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful, man. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, man.
Yeah. Rob Fusari, thanks for joining us on Rise Up Radio.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
If you know someone who has an inspiring story that we should interview, please email us at info@riseup8.org. I'm Michael Nova, and thanks for joining us on Rise Up Radio.